Sometimes you can get it said with fiction. The book we're talking about today is the kind of book that gets passed around. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Have you read The Raven's Gift? Our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, statewide and toll-free. It's a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talkatalaskapublic.org. Have you heard about the book? Well, you're hearing about it now on Talk of Alaska, statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Sometime around within the first year of Talk of Alaska, I started exploring the idea of whether or not we had an Alaska literature yet. And my theory was we didn't. And others would disagree with me. I think I'm revising my opinion now, and we are seeing the beginnings of an Alaska literature, and I'm really excited about it. And I've been trying to bring some of these new young authors onto the program so that you can get to know them as I have gotten to know them, and also to know their work. And it is on that note that I bring you Don Reardon today, author of The Raven's Gift. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Don.
Oh, wow. Thanks for having me, Steve. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. So you teach writing? Actually, what is it you teach? Not quite writing.
I'm not sure what I teach. I'm just kidding.
At the university.
I teach at UAA. Yeah, I'm a professor
cultural
there.
Cultural something.
It's basically, I teach kind of the beginning college writing in the college prep. So I teach the students who first come in and really hate writing and don't want anything to do with it, and I have to teach them otherwise.
And how do you do that?
The first thing I have them write for an essay is why they hate writing.
And works for me.
Yeah, and they
KISS, huh?
Yeah, we explore that, and pretty soon they actually start to like it. So
yeah. So here, were you born in Bethel, or you just go to school there?
I grew up out there. My mom was a teacher, and my dad was in law enforcement. So I always joke that students that my mom failed with, my dad might have ultimately got. But yeah, we moved out there when I was little in second grade. We lived in Akyak. And then moved back to Montana for a little while where I was born, and then moved back when I was in junior high and stayed out there till I was done with school.
So you're acquainted with the realities of what you're writing about. Probably wouldn't have written it if you hadn't been.
Yeah, yeah. People have asked, like, what research did you do? Well, I grew up out there. It's, I guess, a lifetime of research.
And you spent, and this is important because your central character is a teacher out there. And it's a post-apocalyptic world in which this former teacher exists. But nonetheless, that's the voice of experience there, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it is. Because I went back and taught at home in Bethel after I graduated there and went back to teach English. And knew that the constant churning that happens in rural Alaska with teachers coming in and leaving and learning a little bit about the culture or rejecting it and leaving. And so I saw that struggle, and we had lived that a little bit when we first moved there. And so that's definitely part of the story and a part of what I noticed growing up. And then the post-apocalyptic thing is, I wasn't quite brave enough to do with what Seth Kantner did in Ordinary Wolves. And so I had to put it in the apocalypse.
So you know Seth, I take it.
Yeah, yeah. Seth's the older brother I never had. Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's so interesting because all this is sort of a long-distance relationship.
Yeah.
You know, it's very odd because Alaska really is a giant small town in a lot of ways.
Yeah, yeah, it really is. When I came to grad school...
Seth is not about to leave up there.
Yeah.
I don't think.
No, I don't think so. Yeah.
And you, on the other hand, decided to move to Anchorage and to basically challenge yourself.
Yeah, I was teaching high school and really trying to inspire my students and wanting them to live out their dreams, and realized I wasn't kind of doing it myself. And we had a guest teacher or a guest writer come, and it was Deb Vanoss, come to class and teaching about writing. I could see how inspired my students were, and I was thinking I need to do the same thing and try to. I was going to be a writer since I was a little kid, and I had to go do that. And so I came to school here at UAA and got my MFA, and then started teaching here.
And so how long were you working on this book,
The Raven's Gift? The Raven's Gift, I probably wrote the first draft within about 2 years, a year and a half or 2 years, off and on, writing off and on it. My first novel from grad school, the little novella I wrote, landed me an agent. He tried to sell it, and it didn't sell, but there were editors at major publishers who they said, "Hey, you know, really like your writing."
Oh, good. And, yeah, that's very nice.
Yeah, yeah, and they
can't take it to the bank.
But you can't. Yeah, and they were, "Well, we'd like to see another novel if you have one." And it's not like you could just kind of pull those out of your backside. And so, so I didn't want them to forget my name, so I wrote this kind of as quick as I could to get it to them. So within like a year, I think it was back to some of those editors, and then they still didn't take it. It's been a long road to publication for this novel.
That is so weird. I guess you might as well tell that right now. I mean, for one thing, I can see a publisher in the modern publishing era might have some hesitations about how well is this, what would appear to be a rather gloomy book. Is the public really ready for this?
Yeah, I think that was part of it. And part of it was, this is the Alaska no one's ever really heard about. You know, there haven't been too many novels from Southwest Alaska. And so that was new. And at the same time, it doesn't fit really into a genre quite exactly. You know, I was hoping it was just a good story, and the American publishers want to have a place to put it on the shelf, and that wasn't possible. And then it had some of these end of the world themes to it, and the world seemed to be ending, the stock market's crashing and publishers having problems. And so they just couldn't get it past their editorial boards. And so ultimately the big publishers passed on it, and it seemed like the world was ending for my writing. And then Penguin Canada took the book. And once they took the book, then I had a publisher, and that was super exciting, and it was a major publisher. And then I realized people in the U.S. couldn't get my book. People in Alaska couldn't get their hands on a copy.
They were mailing it.
Yeah.
They were handing it off.
They were handing it off.
But this book got here before it was published here.
Yeah, yeah.
I know people that were reading this book before you could get it.
There were people trading it in the village for Gus Bucks and all kinds of things. Yeah, it was really amazing to me, and then also at the same time kind of frustrating.
Okay, so now it's out.
Now it's out.
Now anybody can get it.
Now anybody can get it, and that's weird and cool at the same time. Yeah.
And so that means that people will start comparing notes about the stories and so forth, or the story, I guess we'll call it. The telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A special invitation to anyone who's actually read The Raven's Gift and is getting to know the author and is a little shy about calling. Don't be shy. Go ahead and call. And he's not going to be playing coy about the plot of this book. He told me before the show, he says, "Look, I just can't stand to listen to those talk shows where they don't want to give things away." So
all three of you who've read it can call in.
I personally Mom? Know. I'm amazed at people I know that have read the book that I didn't know have read the book. Let me put it that way. It's more than half a dozen, buddy.
All right. I'll take that to the bank.
Yeah. Well, let's see. This book really doesn't cover that much geographic territory when you think about it. It doesn't get much up the river past Bethel.
Yeah, yeah. I think in terms of mileage, they don't travel more than probably 75 miles, if even that.
Wow. Yeah.
It's hard country to travel if you're on foot.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But I mean, they do. There is the river there.
Yeah, yeah.
So here is the post-apocalyptic situation. The book opens and we don't know why there's all this devastation. And in one sense, we never totally find out, but it appears that it's maybe a disease, maybe the bird flu got loose or something like that. And And this has become like a triage or quarantine area or something. Anyway, the result is enormous devastation. Essentially, the villages are pretty much wiped out. There's a few survivals around, but some are not surviving as being very human.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so there's your situation. And the book just plays through this situation kind of like The Road, really, like Cormac McCarthy's, but not with the same gloomy sort of overcast, I guess you would say. But nonetheless, that's all there is in this book. And after a while, you just start asking yourself some questions and say, well, wait a second. Is this the future?
Yeah. Or is it right now?
Yeah. You know? Or is it the past?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's, I guess that was in your mind.
Yeah. The germ for this novel, if I could use such a ridiculous pun, is that the situation right now, you know, that's in rural Alaska, this idea that we have diseases that the CDC is out studying and we have live cases of tuberculosis, and those kind of questions leave people to ask, why is this right now? You know, why does such a high percentage of people in Alaska lack sanitation, you know? And so those kind of questions have always kind of troubled me in a state that's so ridiculously wealthy with tens of billions of dollars in the bank. And money's not necessarily a solution, but just that question has always troubled me. And I guess the way I wanted to answer it was through story and explore this idea of why and what could be done. And ultimately it comes down to me that there's still the knowledge of how to live and how to be human beings that's there, even within all of the kind of bad things that can be happening in rural Alaska. There's still a beauty and a strength and a sense of hope that's there, that even though we still just struggle with these losses, you know, as somebody who's grown up in Southwest Alaska, I can't even count how many friends I've lost to various tragedies. And it kind of makes you numb to that. And as a writer and somebody in touch with my feelings and my emotions, that's really troubling to even know that I feel that way myself, that I'm numb to that. And so I think I was trying to put some of that into this story in the sense of people living in a situation and kind of asking, like, why is this happening? Why is no one coming to help? What's going on? And then at the same time realizing we have to save ourselves.
You've been on the radio before, I can tell.
Yeah.
Because you know what dead air is.
I know what dead air is.
And you don't like it. And all of us in the radio business, we don't like dead air. But I've discovered you got to have a little dead air when you do a talk show.
Yeah, yeah. It's dead air is scary.
It's
I use that
scary.
in the story. The idea, yeah. You turn the radio on and there's no one there.
There's no one there.
Especially in the bush, you know, the radio is so important. It's crazy. My parents found out I was getting married on the radio through KSKO in McGrath. They have the message board, and it was something like to Bob and Mary on the Takotna, clean the cobwebs out of the honeymoon cabin or something like that.
Right.
Yeah.
It's often in some kind of code.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's great to have you on the show, and it's great just to be talking about some of the realities of Western Alaska life, something I'm not all that familiar with, really. You know, I've been to Dillingham a number of times and you know, gotten to know people there, but mostly in the villages around Bethel, I don't know a whole lot and haven't been to. It would appear that you strike a note, and I found it's very interesting that a whole lot of my friends and acquaintances that are Alaska natives are not, They're not taking umbrage at you appropriating their stuff at all, it doesn't seem.
Yeah, yeah. I was worried about that. I was worried
you would have to be.
Yeah. At the same time, I grew up with those stories. So the story of the Big Mouth Baby is a famous story in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, and it's scary, this little baby that ends up eating people because it wasn't taken care of appropriately. And so, yeah, that was a really big concern of mine. But at the same time, I've been sharing that story with Yupik students. And like when I was on basketball trips with my athletes and telling them, and some of them had never heard it, you know, and the idea of if you know one of those stories and it's so powerful and so important and you're not sharing it, then it's being lost. And so then when I get to share it and I know that those kids will pass it on, that's kind of important to me. And then at the same time, I don't think I quite understood while I was writing this the power of those stories in terms of, they're kind of in our DNA, I think, as human beings. You know, our culture, our identity as humans was initially passed along through stories. The whole idea of how to be a human was passed through stories. And that was how school happened initially, you know, and should still happen. Stories are great. You know, it's a part of who we are. And these stories, there's kind of, to me, a magic to them. As I was playing with them and writing them, I didn't even realize that this book really is essentially the Big Mouth Baby story in like a bigger context. I didn't realize it till I was done and said, whoa, this whole story is that kind of captured in a novel form. And so...
Well, I think there's part of the art.
Yeah.
I think just as you say, well, is this the past? Is this the future? Is this the present? Is this the present with just one thing changed? Or is this the present with really nothing changed?
Yeah.
Just a little bit different look at it, a different look at the speed at which things happen. Because genocide is not always a fast process.
Yeah.
But there have been a couple of times now where genocide has nearly been accomplished in Western Alaska. Not just the flu epidemic, but before that.
Yeah.
And it must not have been much of a picnic that well, was it even overlapping the flu epidemic the summer that never came?
Yeah, yeah. There's so many
these are big deals when you're subsisting.
Yeah. When you, as I grew up, just the stories of the elders who had survived some of those epidemics were just amazing. They haunted me, and I think that's part of why I had to write the story this way and have it be kind of scary and exciting all at the same time.
And it does linger there is still in the memory of your oldest character, some of this stories that were told and so forth about earlier genocides.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
now we have another one. We never really quite get to the bottom of what it is, but it's clearly, you know, something very, very destructive is happening. And we don't even know how far this gets out, is out into the larger world or anything about that. And then by the time you get to the end of the book, you don't care.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
it's not resolved.
Yeah.
How the hell did you do that?
I don't know. I think that's some of the magic of the story for me writing.
Really?
It. Really? Yeah.
To
yeah.
make it just make it circle in on itself somehow.
Yeah, I think that's kind of that magic of the Big Mouth Baby story and some of those other traditional stories that are kind of embedded in this novel.
Well, we've gotten in it really deep. I think we better start taking some phone calls.
Okay.
Our guest is Don Reardon, author of The Raven's Gift. We're especially inviting people who've read the book to call, but not necessarily. 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. And I have emailed here, too, at talk@alaskapublic.org. And Kay joins the program from down in Juneau. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Kay, with Don Reardon.
Thank you. Thanks, Steve. What a great person to have on. And I haven't read Don's book. I am a teacher. I've been a college professor for many years, and I'm retired. And I just spent this last school year working in three communities up the Kuskokwim from Bethel, and many of the things that Don's been talking about concerning the issues of sanitation and just the almost third world conditions in our, you know, very wealthy state and our very wealthy country are of deep concern to me too. I was working in a program that was really based it was administered by the school district, but it was really community based. It was a early childhood infant toddler or prenatal to age three. And one of the things that I worried about a lot was just the issues of creating animosity or creating sort of antagonism, because a lot of I think what the modern early childhood approach is quite different, you know, from the traditional child rearing ways that may or may not still be intact. And of course, my experience is that you know, it was very hard to really see or find out how much traditional child rearing was actually occurring, just because of the influences of schools and change in general. But while I was there, there were a few deaths. Some were from alcohol. You know, one was alcohol poisoning, a teenager. There were meningitis, death of an infant, and lots of people I knew were getting bacterial pneumonia because of drinking water in their houses, or they were respirating. Somehow they were respirating the bacteria, I don't know, either from the water or from their own saliva or something, because I guess we have bacterial pneumonia, you know, it's rampant in our bodies. Anyway, it's just a matter of, you know, our being able to get clean water. But I'm wondering if Don would like to talk about kind of some of the, well, just the issue of being a non-native person in a rural community, and how difficult it is to adjust one's own thinking and being to the flow of this community or the communities, and to find one's way amid the problems that exist in rural communities that have existed really for, you know, since those epidemics, or since, I mean, probably long after colonization. But it's almost as though the reliving and the resentment, again, that is still in existence concerning all those bad things that have happened, have somehow kept people from moving on, or kept people from making the changes that they really want to make. I think they really want to make for the better for themselves. And one last point that I just wanted to make was how difficult it was while I was out there for me listening to people who really were trying to live a subsistence lifestyle to do so. It seems like our state government is making it harder and harder for people to practice subsistence, which should be automatic and just a basic right for Alaska Native people.
That's a big question, Kay. Let's see what he does with it.
Yeah. Okay, I'll just hang up now and let somebody else call in.
All right. Bye. Thanks a lot.
The third rail of Alaska has appeared on public radio.
Yes, as it
thanks
as
for calling,
does.
Kay. A lot of great points there. The one that I am most comfortable addressing, I guess, is just growing up there as a kid. I was, I think, getting to come there as a kid versus coming in as a complete outsider. As a child, you're not necessarily an outsider so much. I mean, the first village that I moved to, I think I might have been the first white boy to live there in a number of years, and so I got my butt kicked a little bit initially. There was a little bit of a learning curve for me, but ultimately the people were so kind and generous. And also, I moved there as a hunter. I, you know, as a little kid, my dad had taught me to hunt since a young age, and so I was just, that's all I was into as a kid, was hunting and ghost stories, and that kind of fit in perfectly with the culture, and I just wanted to learn as much as I could, and so that made the transition a lot easier for me personally, I think, and just being, wanting to learn and wanting to understand that way of life, and just being totally mesmerized by the old way of living and how people used to live. That was something that just enamored me. And so that made my transition quite a bit easier. Some of your other points, I don't know how many of them that I want to hit there. There's some good ones there. The idea, I guess, of Alaska, say for instance, if we take the topic of suicide, which is not talked about enough and not talked about at all where I grew up at the time, Alaska has the highest rates of suicide in the country. And we're still not quite addressing the actual issues, this idea of hopelessness, or this, you know, if you have an epidemic and they're calling suicide an epidemic, then what are you doing to stem the situation or stop it? And we're not doing enough, I think, as long as it kind of keeps happening.
there's a book that I would recommend by Harold Napoleon called Yuyarak, The Way of the Human Being. And that's a really short book, but it's great. And for me, it was the first book that I ever read from a Yupik writer. He's from Hooper Bay. And it's the first time I read a book that helped me understand, you know, like, why were some of my friends dead or in jail? Why is the situation the way it is out there? And that book, it kind of explains it, this idea of the stress from the epidemics hitting and creating PTSD, you know, like post-traumatic stress on people. And I think that's kind of still happening.
Even down the generations.
Down the generations, yeah. And now they're starting to prove some of that with babies, you know, like suffering in utero from if there's violence happening at a household or something, that babies are being born into this violence or into these problems.
Yeah, I would throw in this observation, 2K, that cross-cultural communication is fairly easy on a certain level, a certain intertribal feel-good sort of level is actually powwow level. It's kind of easy. You can just get the old drum going and everybody's smiling and you feel good. That's one level of it. To get deeper in cross-cultural communication is a true challenge to try and figure out what is in another, what of what I'm trying to communicate is getting across and in which way and how is it being misinterpreted and so forth. That is an enormous challenge. And I would like to see that challenge picked up more in Alaska because I think Absolutely. We're challenged cross-culturally in many ways in this state and we will be increasingly, and we probably have the tools to show some world leadership in cross-cultural communication down years from now, especially along the Pacific Rim and with our circumpolar neighbors, our Russian neighbors. There's a lot of ground to be broken in this. And also I will say this, Don. I think you touched very briefly on suicide, genocide, and so forth. But I think in this book, in the narrative of this book, you cross over it over and over again and from a number of different directions and metaphorically.
Yeah.
You're never far from it in this book. So I'll leave it at that. Telephone number 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. An email from Laura Spano at Red Cross saying, thank you so much, Don, for launching your book as a benefit for the flood victims. And we might add in the sanitation issue there where you know, the sewage lagoon flooded.
Yeah.
So this is not just any old water that flooded in there.
Yeah.
She said, for Don's book launch, he decided to raise funds for Red Cross disaster relief efforts. And he sparked $1,106 at his launch at Taproot and an additional $1,210 online. Thank you very much from the Red Cross.
Cool. Thanks. Well, there's some big time donors there. And also Fireside Books was donating a portion of the sales there too, to the Red Cross. So
yeah, well, doing some good in Galena and elsewhere up and down the river.
Well, we have to,
yeah.
You know, like we Alaskans, we help each other out. And I think that's just part of how it needs to be and should be.
Let's go to Eric, joins the program from Bethel. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Eric, with Don Reardon.
Oh, hi. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
I just want to say, as a person who's lived in Bethel for several years, and I do a lot of skiing on the river and traveling around, reading it, it was just super, it seemed to me really accurate visually. I could just picture this whole thing happening, and it was really well done. I just want to compliment him. Another thing, it was, you could pick characters and scenes and spots that really do exist that were into the story, and it just made it really come to life for me.
Well, thanks, Eric. I was sort of cheating, of course, using some things from Bethel. And maybe even people who, the one person who skis all over the tundra.
Oh, yeah. I was just thinking, Eric, you might be the person that inspires the mysterious force.
Well, I don't know, just visually looking, reading that was just, you could go right through it and just picture everything. So I'd encourage any movie producers to just grab a camera. You could make this movie in about.
Yeah, that's what I would like to see happen out there. I would like to see it happen. And I've tried to pitch it that way, that you don't even have to create the post-apocalyptic sets. You can just go out to Bethel.
Well, you know, when I think about it, it has a certain storyboard potential because you have one reality when you're on the river, at the surface of the river, because there's always some bluff. You don't really know what is going on up there, and it's always some mystery when you Google people. And it's just like that. You know what I'm talking about, Eric.
it's always something.
Yeah. Well, Eric, thanks for your call. Anything else?
Nope. Good job. I enjoy the book, and I encourage anybody out there listening, pick up a copy.
Yeah, I think they will be.
Thanks, Eric.
I think we're selling a few books right now as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Admissions representatives from Brown University, MIT, and from Yale University are hosting college information sessions to discuss academic programs, campus life, selective college admissions, and financial aid. On Saturday, July 13th, the session will be in Anchorage in the Assembly Chambers at Lusac Library. And on Sunday, July 14th, the session will be in Juneau at the downtown branch of the Juneau Public Library. Register online at admissions.yale.edu. This message sponsored by Yale University.
The subject is the book, The Raven's Gift. It's just out. It's written by Don Reardon. It actually was released in Canada, and people started smuggling copies over into Alaska because, of course, it's set in Western Alaska. It's set really up and down a very small portion of the Kuskokwim River, and it portrays an Alaska we don't really see in novels very much. The author is with us, Don Reardon, and people who have read the book have been actually getting in touch, and one has email. This is from Lynn Love Green. She says, I think it's a she. I've read The Raven's Gift. It's one of the best books I've read in the last few years. One thing I enjoy is the different layers or themes. You can enjoy it simply as a post-apocalyptic story and turn the page and see who survives. It works totally on that level. But there's also the other themes you've mentioned. My question is, did you go back and layer in the other ideas as you revised? What was your writing process for that? Well, we went into that a little bit, but why don't you go ahead and take another shot at it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I didn't really go back and do those layers. The way that you read the book is how I wrote it. It's a fractured narrative, which means it's all split up. There's three different timelines that are happening through the story. And I wrote it that way. And mostly because I would start writing and get to a spot where I would kind of get scared and decide I need to go to another spot or wasn't sure what was going to happen. And when I'm writing, I'm mostly just kind of experiencing it and recording it. Like I'm watching it like it's a movie and just recording it, what I'm seeing and feeling and hearing. And so the three sections just kind of came that way. There's only a couple that the editors looked at and said, maybe this should be here and that should be there. And I put those in. The one thing that was really interesting for me in terms of writing was I wrote the story and then I decided I wanted epigraphs at the beginning of each chapter. And so I went and then did some research to find those, and I would find amazing stuff that fit with the story. And so I had 20 or 25 of these things, and the editors cut it back to 3 or 4 of them. But some of them I really liked. If we have time, I'd share a couple of those.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, we'll pop to that in a little bit. But let's go ahead and...
Okay.
We have Mary, who has posted a picture of herself here saying, I got the Canadian edition months ago. She posted a picture of her looking at the looking over top of that. It looks like kind of a black and white or a bluish.
It's kind of a green, mysterious sort of cover, the Canadian cover is, with some mountains in the background and kind of a tundra lake and some black spruce in the front.
And this one is also limited in its palette and consists of red and black, basically, in the American edition. And it's a pintail book now from Penguin.com. Mm?
Yeah.
Yeah. What does that mean, pintail? Do you know?
Pintail is, the duck.
Well, I know that, but it's just penguin multiplying into other species, basically.
Yeah, penguin. A
British publisher. Who knows where they're based anymore?
I told them it made no sense to have a penguin in Alaska. I was like, we just can't do that. So they said, how does pintail work? I'm joking.
Yeah. You almost had me there, though. Let's go to Lizzie, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Lizzie.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Don.
Hi, Lizzie.
I was interested in that your book came out so much in Canada, so much longer before it came out in the U.S., and I was interested in your thoughts on that and why you think there was easier to get a reception in Canada than the U.S., and then how the reception is comparing between the two countries. So thank you.
All right, Lizzie.
Yeah, thanks Lizzie. That's a good question that I don't really have an answer for. I kind of make up answers since I write fiction. and for that one, I don't know why it took so long. I put in a lot of work to try to get it here. And finally, this imprint is actually kind of a boutique imprint from Canada. And so the Canadians did this. So they're one of my new favorite countries because of that. Our friends to the south, they pushed this to get it here in the U.S. And I think mostly because of the success in Alaska, they paid attention to that and realized that there's a readership in the U.S. that would take it. And so they're the ones behind it and finally got this imprint of Pintail, which is really Canadian books that the Canadians thought would do well in the U.S. and maybe the U.S. didn't. I'm not sure. I think that's kind of the
story. Well, that's a whole other approach.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it used to be, I remember years ago, that the Canadian government would put a whole lot of money into subsidizing, for instance, musicians and the National Film Board of Canada. That's why it was created, because they were so nervous that the American media would become dominant in style and there wouldn't be a Canadian style.
Yeah.
This is like a reverse colonization effort.
It sort of is. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And in Canada, I had one review that was a really good review. And then at the end it said, but it's definitely not literary. And that's kind of the kiss of death in Canada. Canada's all about literary fiction. And in the U.S. it's kind of different, you know. They're like, well, what genre is it in? And literary can kind of be the kiss of death. And so that might have been part of that.
Oh, that's interesting, huh? I was going to say, but it's not Canadian. I was thinking it would be literary because, actually, I think the cover, your Canadian cover looks more literary than the U.S. cover.
Yeah, this is definitely being sold more as mystery suspense thriller. And it has some of that, I guess, yeah. I just hope it's just a story people enjoy and doesn't need to fit. I mean, there's romance, there's survival. It's a little bit of everything.
I was thinking, it could be that, Alaskan taste may be closer to Canadian taste than it is to, New York taste, is my thought of.
I think there's also just this matter of this is an Alaska reality, so a bunch of Alaskans are acquainted with that reality and they're interested in any kind of tale set there, and it's just icing on the cake if it's got thrills.
Right, yeah, and then I think the Canadians have, they have similar experience.
Yeah. Well, they certainly have the same genocidal forces going on there.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the call, Lizzie.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Okay, you're welcome.
1-800-478-8255, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. The topic, The Raven's Gift by Don Reardon. He's with us. He's Assistant Professor of Developmental Studies at the University of Alaska, Anchorage. And he tells me that really means teaching English to
Yeah, people teaching writing. Yep, teaching English for sure.
Yeah. Well, this is interesting. Where'd you get the audacity? This is a lot of pages here, kiddo.
The audacity.
To think you could pull this off.
I don't know. I don't think.
Well, you say it was in you.
It was just, yeah, I think it was just kind of in me, and just a story mostly coming from just questions of why is the situation like this in Alaska and why is no one helping, and going from that area of kind of deep concern and the idea of all these giant kind of corporate conglomerates coming in, mining companies and those kind of things. I needed to somehow address those questions, if only for myself. And so I think that's what I was doing. I was just writing a story to explore my own emotions and feelings. And this book came out of that.
We don't ever get a good answer for why is no one helping, do we?
We don't. And I think that's the rub, and that's kind of, I didn't come up with an answer. I have an idea of how the story might be continuing in my head, and so someday I might have to write that, but really for me there can't be an answer until we have some answers of our own.
I had the author Ruxana Khan on one time. She had a very compelling character, and she everybody wanted a sequel because they fell in love with the character, but what she wanted for the character and what her readers wanted for the character totally other things. Was a real problem for her.
Yeah, yeah.
She said, I want the girl to finally have some fun. The whole idea was she was a good girl. She never did get to have fun. You can't do that.
In writing this, there were some moments where I got kind of scared myself with the situation that my character was in. And at one point, really late at night when I was writing, I had to stop and just put it down. And so I was getting spooked out because I was all by myself, and it was late at night. And so I thought, well, and it was the first time I'd ever even thought about publication or people reading it and thinking somebody might ask me, like, what kind of research did you do? And so I thought, you know what, I'm going to do a little research. And I was about maybe a third of the way into the book at the school scene. For those that have read it, there's a really scary scene in the school, and it's mostly because everything's destroyed and the school's not. And so that, for some reason, that's scary, the idea that the school is been left alone and some bad stuff has happened there. And so I decided to do a little research, and I got online, and in about 5 minutes I had scared myself silly with the actual plans, government plans of bird flu and quarantine and evacuation, that kind of stuff. It was way scarier than the stuff my character was in.
You didn't really need to make anything up.
I didn't need to, and this scenario that I had just dreamed up is real and on paper, and available for the public to read, you know, at any one of the government planning, emergency planning sites.
We'll just dam it off someplace down the Cusco from McGrath, and that's it.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a sacrifice area down there.
And some of it's actually really funny and kind of scary.
But, I mean, during the flu epidemic, there were similar, you know, quarantines and so forth.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean, people were very grateful for these drastic public health measures in some cases.
Yeah, yeah. And it's scary. The plans definitely say, if you know, that Alaska could be quarantined if something were to happen here. And we're at the epicenter for bird flu. I just read a study that just was published a couple days ago that says they've found small traces of bird flu in the YK Delta. And that's scary.
Well, yeah, and we're getting malaria mosquitoes now.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I'll tell you more. We're going to get more and more PSP at weird times of the year.
You can
bet on it. We're getting Vibrio now up. It's actually made its way across the Alaska Peninsula and made its way into Bristol Bay. And they don't want that out. All this is bound to happen. I mean,
yeah, yeah.
Think about it. Predators and pathogens, they're going to reproduce and evolve faster than a lot of other things. That's just the way it is.
Yeah, yeah. And that's I guess what's scary about it to me is that these things have happened here in Alaska before, and we don't seem to have learned from them. We're not really ready. There's these plans of what we should do or what could happen, but we haven't really done anything. I haven't seen us actively preparing like we should, and I don't mean in the kind of wild prepper sense. I just mean in common sense. You know, if the projections for something like bird flu are going to come here, then we should maybe kind of be getting ready for that. Everybody should.
Well, that's those plans you're reading. That's their way of getting ready for
getting
it.
Getting ready for it, yeah.
Seriously, this is the technocrats dominate public health field, and they feel justified in being that way because they think people are so stupid that they'll mess it up if they don't leave it to the experts. I'm not kidding.
Yeah, no, I know. There's on one of the plans they have there's 15 assumptions about, say, something going pandemic. And the one that kind of fits my story is one of these assumptions is most people who have access, I'm reading this directly, who have access to clean water, food, sanitation, fuel, and nursing and medical care while they're sick will survive. And well, that's just fine if you're somewhere where that is. But, you know, a good portion of Alaska, that's not the case.
Wow, you just said it all. Wow, I think we should go ahead and take our break. I got emails, I got phone calls, and I want to get to some of those little epigrams you've got, so don't forget that as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com, and by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com.
Okay, this comes in about Don Reardon's book, The Raven's Gift from Helena. Crucial social impact, yes. Beautiful personal insight, yes. Thought-provoking, yes. But it's also a can't-put-it-down, totally gripping page-turner, exclamation point. Many thanks for a great read. Terrifying, but also a totally great read. She's totally great.
Wow. Nice. Thank you. That's amazing. I'm blushing. Can you see that on radio?
No, not quite. Were you in that kind of frenzy when you were writing it? I mean, you write pretty fast.
Yeah, probably. I think through some of the scenes, I do that. I work my first draft through pretty quickly because I'm just seeing it and experiencing it, and then go back and cut out lots of stuff.
Yeah, Stephen King used to do that too.
I was in second grade, I wanted to be Stephen King. I read
it all comes out now.
Yeah, the summer of second grade. So going into third grade, I stole a copy of my cousin's book, The Shining, and read that. And I was ruined. You know?
Sally joins the program from Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Sally, with Don Reardon.
Thank you. Don, are you related to Jim Reardon?
No, I'm not. I grew up with his kids and his grandkids in Bethel, though.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Jim Reardon used to come and visit my parents in Alaska when I was a kid. I grew up there.
He's a great storyteller, and I think my dad has every copy of his book.
Yeah. I wanted to say I was a second or third generation Dillingham dweller. My dad's parents moved there in the 1930s, and I grew up there and now live in Fairbanks. But I want to say that growing up there as a child, there were many things I experienced that I might not have experienced quite so directly if I'd been an adult, such as how Native children were treated in the schools and that sort of thing. And the other thing I want to say is I've been doing grief counseling now for many years and have acquired, I think, a perception of what it means for a whole culture to suffer a death. And that's what I see, having been in the interior quite a while. Most of what I've learned about that has come from people in the interior, and it is every bit, if not more, a loss than losing an individual, and that comes up over and over again as I'm sitting with people and trying to help them as they're recovering and healing from loss. I think this bears directly on the topic of suicide, the sense that hopelessness can be approached at an item by item level, you know, well, it's because I lost my job, or it's because my fishing isn't good, or something happened between me and my partner. But underlying that much more deeply is that sense of having been cut off at the roots and trying to find a way to put down roots in an unfamiliar and in many ways inhospitable soil, if that makes sense.
Yes, yeah. You said it all, Sally. Very powerful.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the reason I wanted to say that, I think, is because we do, those of us who care widely about people, want to help. However, I don't know how we can't fix that. We can be supportive of people, but I think the most important thing we can do is to be understanding. What would it feel like to you or to me if someone were to come along and run a sharp knife under my feet and say, okay, now everything that, all your foundation, everything that your feet stand on is now, it's illegal, it's wrong, it's sinful, and you can no longer relate to the world in that way. What would we do? We'd be floating off into space and doing what we could to try to help ourselves feel a little better.
Sally, I have you read the book?
No, I haven't.
I think you're going to find some layers in there that might really interest you.
Yeah, I will. I'm going to the library today, and I'll check and see. And if they don't have it, I'm going to ask them to get it and get on the list for it. Definitely.
Great. Thanks, Sally. And thanks for your comments.
Okay, thank you.
I'm thinking that one wonderful thing about roots is that they will grow. They just give them a chance to get hold, and that you can't hold them back.
Yeah, yeah. And the idea of saving the kids is really something that where we should focus. And the knowledge of the elders and getting the youth with them and finding a way to connect and I think even at the simplest levels, you know, a lot of our Alaska Native youth don't know their traditional heroes. They haven't heard of those traditional stories about the heroes, the warriors. And there's a resistance to kind of talk about the fighting that used to happen, that, you know, that the people fought. But that, to me, this idea that there were traditional heroes and warriors who fought is something that should be shared with the youth so that they can have heroes that look like them, and they can understand that they have the blood of those heroes inside them, because otherwise your heroes are rappers and basketball stars. You know, you're identifying instead with a culture you see on TV that doesn't really equate or mesh up with the life that you're living other than basketball and guns, you know, like tying those two together, and instead giving some people hope by showing them who they're traditional heroes were, and that they can fight and stand up for their own rights and beliefs and make their own way and fight to survive even.
You know, I think you're on your way to becoming a young elder.
I have a long ways to go. We have way too much to learn.
Well, we need young elders. I don't think we're going to get anywhere without young elders. I've become convinced of that.
Well, I think there's, you know, you lose an elder like Oscar Quagley, and you've lost more than just a library, you know. And so when you lose
lost
somebody
a whole history of intercultural relations that you can't get back.
And even I just look back as a kid and just wish I would have spent more time with somebody like George Keene out in Kasigluk, who was just an amazing elder. And the times where I got to learn from him are things that I'll just never forget. And I wish I would have, you know.
Yeah, but you got to see the young elder part is that you need to be passing that stuff on now.
I'm trying to.
Oh, good.
Yeah, yeah. In the around town here, they have Club Kula for Native boys, and I go there and do little things like this, like we do a spirit warrior thing where they lay on the ground and trace their outline, and then they imagine what their spirit warrior was and draw on it and kind of reconnect with who they were. So I try to do things like that. But
maybe we can make Raven's Gift into a video game.
That might... There you have an idea. Yeah.
Well, we already know it could be storyboarded, and I'm just thinking, yeah.
I would rather have people out on the land maybe reading it hunkered down in a tent, you know, experiencing life like that instead of at a TV screen playing video games. But however the knowledge can be transmitted, I think it has to be.
Many handheld devices these days.
This is true.
Let's go to Donna, joins the program from Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Donna.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
Nice to talk to you, Dawn. I'm looking forward to reading the book. Haven't gotten it yet, but I was interested to hear that you wrote the book for yourself. And I was wondering, when you teach writing, is that what you suggest to your students?
Oh, really good question. Well, I also teach them to write to the teacher so they get an A. I'm just kidding. I don't know. I don't know if I teach that way, teach about writing. I guess first and foremost, when I'm working with really reluctant writers, unless it's one of my honors classes, and even those students are reluctant to write. Mostly, I'm just getting them going, and so I have to have them accessing the parts of their brain that want to speak out and want to tell stories and want to be heard. And so that's what I do as a writing teacher, and so I guess it is for them initially, yeah.
Okay, and you kind of touched on it with referencing the story of the Big Mouth Baby, but as an Alaskan who's grown up here, I've heard lots and lots of stories. And do you find other people's stories creeping into your work? I mean, and how do you handle that?
Oh, that's another really good question. I don't know if I allow that to happen other than maybe some of these traditional stories that I heard maybe as a kid growing up and they were kind of woven in there and embedded in it. While I'm writing a book, I try not to read too many contemporary things just because I don't want any of that bleeding in, or the voice really, or the style of writing. I want to have my own, and so I do try to avoid that a little bit, but I think that's more of just conscious, hey, I'm not going to do that. And
I wasn't really referring to written stories, just, you know, having grown up here, like you say, being around elders, having them, having told you stories.
Yeah, I don't try to, I try not to take people's personal stories and put them into my own novels. Maybe kind of characters that I admire, people, I'll have elements of them in a character, but their own actual life stories, I wouldn't take any.
He draws a line there.
Yeah, I would avoid that unless I really wanted to do that, and then I'd ask him.
Good questions, Donna. Thanks for your call. Donna from Fairbanks. Well done, Reardon. We're out of time.
Wow, that
went
quick.
We didn't even get to a reading.
That's even better. I had a lot of fun. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you so much. A lot of people that I really respect like this book, and I like it too. The Raven's Gift. I want to thank Dave Waldron, Josh Edge.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Providence Imaging Center with Doctors Scott Nespinski and Christopher Reed, providing interpretations of imaging studies with a focus on musculoskeletal radiology. PROVimaging.com. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.